This week's episode is sponsored by Spaces. Spaces is a new platform backed by 15 plus years of educator feedback designed to document the process and progress behind student learning in your classroom. Join the Spaces community to connect with educators across North America and gain access to free teacher-created resources, help educators who are just starting out on their journey, and learn new things from teachers who have been there before. So visit community.spacesedu.com today.
Is this the teacher hotline?
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Teacher Hotline. My name is Ronald Hay, where we try to answer some of the most pressing questions for teachers in and outside of the classroom. Today, we have Katie from the Toronto District School Board. Katie, how can we help you today?
Hi, Ron. I've been an elementary school teacher for 25 years. With kids getting phones at a younger age, everything being on the internet, and now coming out of online learning, students are becoming more reliant on technology in their education. I was wondering how other teachers promote digital literacy to their students, because I know technology will be in their lives, and I want to make sure these kids grow up using digital technology responsibly. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on how other teachers integrate these lessons into their classroom. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Katie. You are absolutely right. Kids nowadays are growing up in a different environment than all of us. The use of technology in the classroom and everyone's lives is just part of growing up now, and we just need to find a way to embrace it. That means teaching kids how to use technology responsibly is going to be more important than ever. So today I bring in an expert, Rochelle Denae-Poth, an educator, consultant, attorney, and keynote speaker. Rochelle is a Spanish and technology teacher from Oakmont, Pennsylvania. Rochelle has a clear love for learning. She has just earned her Juris Doctor degree, a master's in instructional technology, and currently pursuing a doctorate in instructional technology. She's also the author of 7 books and also the host of her own podcast called Thrive in Edu, which you can find on all streaming platforms. Rochelle, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk with you today and to answer some of the questions posed here and see how I can help, and definitely looking forward to learning as well.
Lots and lots of questions. And I want to start off the show by asking you, in your own words, what does it mean to be digitally literate in today's environment? Because I think that word has different meanings to different people.
Yeah, it definitely does. And, the growth in the number of technology apps and tools and ways we get information and the ways that we work and we learn and all of these things. I mean, it's crazy to think how much growth there has been and how different like school and work are, especially now compared with 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago when I was a student. And I think the actual definition of it or what it looks like is going to continue to change just because there are all of these different technologies that are coming out. And so thinking about it, I mean, just if somebody says to me, like, what does it mean, like you said, to be digitally literate?
It's a tongue twister.
I know, usually digital citizenship gets me, and I've practiced that one. But to have these skills, it's like, staying up to date with what are the tools that are out there. I mean, speaking from an educator's perspective, knowing how to communicate with other people online, knowing how to share ideas online, knowing how to access and process and, use the information that we're finding, and being able to distinguish whether it's like actual legitimate resources, is it fake news, and everything in between there. It's really navigating the digital space, finding the information that you need. I wish it existed when I was in school, so I didn't spend so much time in the Dewey Decimal System and the card catalog. But there's so much information out there that, you don't always want to go to like the first thing that you find when you do a Google search. It's knowing how to look at when was it published, who published it, is it accurate, reliable, and all of those things. I mean, there's a process through it, but it's something that even us as adults, as educators, we have to continue to build our skills as well.
So you mentioned about learning this in school. Do you think that there's a certain age or grade where we should begin educating our students and promoting digital literacy? You know, is it sort of at the younger age when they're in grade one and grade two, heck, even in kindergarten? Mm-hmm. Or is it something that should be more taught at the older ages where maybe perhaps using technology is a little bit more common?
Well, you know, if you had asked me that question like 2 years ago, I probably would have had a different answer. But seeing as how when schools closed in March 2020 and had to shift to fully virtual learning, students who were not using the technology for learning, especially like elementary school students, had to learn because that was the only way that they were connecting with their teachers. And so there are, you know, definitely ways that we can help students understand. I mean, I know I've gone out to restaurants or different places and you see little kids that are 3 and 4 years old holding devices. So they're already, they got them in their hands. And so I don't think it's too early. You know, as soon as we have an opportunity where we can teach a lesson, and it's going to look differently at different age levels, of course, but by the ways that you bring these opportunities in, the discussions that you have with students, but with all things, even digital citizenship, you know, teaching kids when they're younger and just applying different skills in different ways as they engage and interact in these digital spaces is going to evolve over time. So while somebody who's 5, I might not explain to them, you know, social media and posting online and using Snapchat, whereas students in high school, those are things that I would talk to them about. You know, I might talk to younger students about like, these are how people communicate. Here's some examples. This is what it looks like. But wouldn't go as in depth into some of those conversations. So I don't know that there's too young an age. I mean, as soon as the students, well, kids, you know, they're involved and surrounded by technology all the time. So there's even quick little lessons about things that can happen at any age, at least is what I think.
Here's an interesting thing. I've had conversations with some of my friends who are now having kids. And the question that always comes up is, you know, like for instance, when I grew up as a kid, you know, I didn't have my first phone, like as embarrassing as it sounds, to like when I was like in university. Mm-hmm. And now you see these kids have like iPhones and like grade 5, grade 6. And I don't know about you, but like in my school, like it can be very like addicting for these kids. So I guess the question becomes, sure, we're teaching this stuff where we're introducing all this technology and apps and all these amazing tools to these kids. Mm-hmm. But do you think that this could be more harm than good because it does have this addiction factor and kids can't, I don't know, like some of my kids in my class can't even pay attention because they got their phone in their hands. I don't know what your thoughts about that is. I know it's a very philosophical question.
It is, yeah. But, you know, I think, and I was in a conversation recently about the technology use and if people were noticing a change with students in school and were they on their phones more and how do you handle that? And I think, especially the past 2 years, I mean, that's what we relied on to keep everything going, whether learning or working or just with families and friends. I mean, we needed that. And so if students were learning at home, just like us, we had a device around us all the time because we weren't going out and engaging, like going to conferences, we weren't in our schools. And so finding that balance, and interestingly enough, a couple of years ago, I had students in Teaching Spanish 3, we did project-based learning. And I had one student who was always on the phone. And I kept saying like, gosh, you're always on that phone. Like, what are you doing? And they ended up using that as their focus, like social media, phone use, technology use for their project-based learning theme. And they compared it with, you know, teenagers in Spain. They did a lot of research. And then they also used the app to track on their phone, their usage. And when they did the presentation, I almost fell out of my chair because they said that over the course of a week, they had spent like 66 hours on their phone. And no. Yeah, it might've even been 68, but it was like 66, 68 hours, somewhere around there. And I said, you know, that's like almost 3 days, like that you're just on your phone. And what were you doing? And they named all of these things, which granted, you know, if we're working, it might be that we're communicating, we're doing the emails. You might even be doing a webinar through your phone sometimes because your computer doesn't work. But the breakdown was like the Netflix and the Snapchats and the gaming and all of these things. And very little of it was focused on, you know, information finding and education purposes, because even at that time we weren't in virtual learning. So it wasn't like kids were using their phones to be on Teams and have the meetings. So there is this, even for adults, you know, you go out and you sit at a restaurant. And I always tell my students in my eighth grade class, because we talk about the use of technology and finding balance, And I say, just look around. Are people actually like talking to one another? Are the phones out on the table in their hands? You know, what is going on? And one thing that I say to my students, and they often laugh at this. And I say, well, are you a president like of a country? Like, obviously not the United States. No. Are you on active military duty? Like, no. I go, wait, are you an on-call surgeon, physician? They're like, no. And I just go with those three. And that's not something that I made up. I read that in a book, and I can't right now think of what the book was, but it might've actually been, and I have to kind of look, Ryan Holiday's book, maybe. He's written a bunch of books about like finding balance and taking a break and so forth. And how even these big leaders took time out of their schedules of running countries and everything to just spend time with family and not be connected. So I think about those types of things, and I say, like, look, you don't need to have the phone out. Like, it's okay to take a break. But I think because over the last 2 years, there was such a reliance on it that it's just become part of the daily experience and habits. I mean, I know even for myself, the first thing when I wake up in the morning, I'm like, clearing out some emails, I'm playing the Wordle, I'm doing, yeah. I'm catching up on Twitter and things like that, just because that's how I start my day. And some of it is informational, because when I go into my classroom, I might, you know, there are certain search terms that I look for that I want to share that information, but it is difficult. And I think, you know, teaching students early on about, you know, take the break, you know, how much screen time and so forth, or evaluating how you're using it and the purpose behind it, I think is what we need to continue to do and model that as adults, as educators as well.
I agree. I think it's actually so hard. Like, I'll be the first to admit, like, I'm very, I don't know, I would maybe even go as far as say, like, I think I might be even addicted to my own phone, which is kind of weird to say on a podcast, right? I'm always on Instagram posting things, I'm checking my emails, I'm messaging people. And sometimes I'm kind of embarrassed to check my own usage. I'm like, I don't want to know. It's one of those, I'd rather not know type of thing.
Right.
But because, you know, you're right. I think as adults, we need to role model some of those behaviors to the kids. But the one thing I think that the kids don't really have experience with because of their age is just this whole concept of being safe online. You used the word digital citizenship before. I don't know. Is this something that you've seen in conferences, talking to other teachers? Is this like a unit or a topic or a lesson that comes up in any curriculum in the States that you've heard of? Like, who should be responsible for teaching digital citizenship to these kids? Is it the parents? Is it the schools? Because
yeah.
I'll be honest, I don't think it shows up in the Canadian curriculum.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, it's everybody, because we're modeling it. So, you know, looking at the educator perspective. So if I'm teaching something in class and I just take all the pictures off of, you know, I found them on the internet so I can use them. I don't cite them or just copy and paste. I mean, you have to model it and teach those lessons for students. Or our own social media, you know, students are resourceful. They Google your names. They're curious about, like, are you on Snapchat? Or, oh my gosh, yeah. You know, you have a Twitter or you're on Facebook.
Yeah.
Like, who does that? But modeling it and talking about it. And then in families and friends, you know, modeling for them too. So parents having conversations with the kids about the responsibilities that come with social media. And I, across the board, whether it's in my Spanish classes or my STEAM, I mean, STEAM, we start with looking at old technology. So they come in, I have a rotary phone and I'm like, you know, I'm like, it's a ton of fun to do these types of things. Or I have a cassette tape and I pull the tape out and I bring in a lot of the old tech. Cause I want them to see like the evolution of where, you know, what it was like when I was their age to now. And then we have a lot of conversations, but a bulk of what we start the year with is digital citizenship. And some of them, you know, they're kind of the borderline age where they're 13 or recently turned 13, so they can get these accounts. And so we talk about it and we'll look, and I have them Google their name. They Google my name or somebody they know to look at it. And I say, you know, sometimes your picture ends up out there. You didn't put it there. You didn't get permission. You were out in public, you were somewhere. And so understanding that even if it's on your phone and you delete it, doesn't mean that it goes away. In anything that we do, I think everybody, you know, has a responsibility to kind of educate one another in the sense, to be, you know, supportive, or to say to friends, even, you know, I've said to some friends and even in myself, like, you know, do you ever have something happen and you get kind of like fired up about it and you want to like respond and you're like, wait, always think, like, pause, think before you click send or tweet or whatever it is. And, you know, just have the conversations, I think, too, ends up being really effective for that. Like, why is this a good post? And then having different resources. So at conferences and things, it is a topic that's really important, especially with the increase in the use of technology and the number of apps that are out there. And then, of course, the stories that you hear of cyberbullying, that's not just even specific to students and younger adults. I mean, that is something that has happened to people in the workplace. And so it's not just a topic that's only relevant to, you know, K through 12. I mean, it spans like beyond education, different sectors of work and life. So it is definitely something that we all need to be part of and, you know, intentional about acknowledging.
Yeah. Cyberbullying, I want to ask you about, cause like, I don't know, first off, do you think that falls under like the whole idea of digital literacy? Like, I don't know, like if it even matters how you categorize it, but it's a thing that obviously happens online. And I don't know, like it's tough because bullying when like I was in high school, it's not to say it was great, but at least teachers could see it happen like physically, right? Like you put it into it. But with digital, cyberbullying, you don't see it. And as teachers, I don't know, like you hear about it, you know it exists, but I don't know, can teachers do anything about that? Can schools do anything about that other than say cyberbullying is bad, don't do it? I don't know. It seems like a very tough battle to fight.
Yeah, it is. And I know that a lot of schools have, you know, policies in place that deal with that, because the thing about it is with the social media, you know, you can get, you know, well, sometimes like students have, some schools have where students can report anonymously, or they will just, they feel comfortable enough going to the guidance department or speaking with, you know, administrators to talk about it, but you have that, you can show it, and they have different schools have different policies in place for how they handle it, because it can, you know, and my students will say, well, I posted that after school. And I said, yeah, but the impact of that is felt within the school. Like that's where the connection is. So you might be posting after school hours, but then the next day when you come, when other people come in and they've seen that post or they've talked about it and it causes a disruption in learning or it leads to other problems. I mean, it's not like when I was in school, you know, people would say, oh, they say something bad about you, but we didn't have the technology. We didn't have the devices. You know, if somebody wrote a note and passed it, sometimes the note was thrown away. Or if somebody said something, you know, it was lost and was forgotten after a period of time and they went on to the next thing. But now it is so much more permanent in so many cases that you have access to, like, here's what somebody said, here's the evidence, here it is. And so schools have been acting upon and do, you know, refer to their policies to, you know, how to handle that. And every school is different. And some may not have that. You know, I can't speak to all of the schools, but I think just because it has been on the rise in the last couple of years with access to so much of the technology tools out there, that it is, you know, high on everybody's radar to be mindful of and to look out for.
Yeah, it just blows my mind some of the stuff I hear stories about, like from other schools and stuff, heck, even stuff on the news. I'm like, I don't know how some of these kids could think that they could write, say, video record, put this stuff on the internet and be like, no one's going to catch me.
Right.
And it just blows my mind. I do this lesson in my grade 12 class, actually, where I teach accounting and we talk about this one lesson on business etiquette and doing, you know, job interviews and stuff. Mm-hmm. And literally I Google search the stuff that they post on the internet and whatever they tweet on Instagram, Snapchat, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to find. Like, it just takes one Google search and all their stuff pops up. Yep. And I put it on the screen and they're like, it blows their mind away. They're like, sir, how did you find that? I'm like, oh, I just typed your name into Google. And you show examples of people losing their jobs over this stuff.
Right.
And yeah, I don't know. It's crazy to think that, you know, as a human being, you just assume this is common sense. But I guess at the younger age, it's common sense is not so common, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. You wonder, and I do some of the same kind of things and activities, in my class as well. And I've shared just experiences or stories of things that I've seen, and even, you know, educators sometimes, and you've probably seen this too on different on social media, on Twitter or Facebook, where the conversations and the interactions are not the most positive, and not that everybody has to always agree, but there is a way to respond, to respect somebody's difference in opinion and so forth. And knowing that you're putting something out there that, like, it's there and somebody can see it. Somebody can screenshot it. They can share it. I mean, there is a longer lasting impact now than there was, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So.
Yeah. It's easy to be a keyboard warrior, right?
Yeah.
It's easy. I think that's what it is. Yeah. Not just with kids. I think with adults, you see it a lot with adults, actually, just pretending to be, you know, the toughest person behind the screen. Mm-hmm. And I don't even want to get into that. That bothers me so much. But the one thing I want to talk about too is, you sort of brought it up in terms of students learning how to source their work early on. Mm-hmm. And that was something that we were taught at a young age. I don't even remember when, about, you know, Wikipedia probably isn't the best source.
Right.
But this is becoming more and more of an issue now with TikTok and social media. And heck, like, I think the vaccine is probably the best example of people where people get their sources mm-hmm. from. Like, I have friends from elementary school that were telling me, oh, by the way, you shouldn't get the vaccine because of blah, 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 blah. Where did you get the source from? They're like, oh, I got it from, you know, Joe Schmo the plumber. So I'm curious here. How do you teach at a young age kids to distinguish between, you know, good sources versus bad sources? Because I remember learning that. I just don't remember when, where, yeah. how. How does that look like in your classroom?
Yeah, you know, I think it was probably 2 years ago, I found some additional websites and things that were out there. There was one that was called, I think, Checkology. And it was like a news literacy project. And it gave, you know, it was very real looking, you know, news items. And you were supposed to go through and decide, like, is this fact? Is this fiction? And it helped. And it kind of guided students as well. Then there was one that was something like spotting the troll. And it was like this mis or disinformation quiz. And you would look at, I think it was social media profiles and different posts, and you would decide based on how it was set up, like, is this a real one? Is this a fake one? Is it a person? Is it, could be artificial intelligence and all of these. And then there were even some games like fake game or fake news games where you would read it. And I mean, it's tough to tell sometimes, especially in the age where now, like, artificial intelligence can generate news and content. And so you don't necessarily even know, like, was it a human that wrote something or was it not? So those are just a couple we did. And even, you know, like Nearpod is a tool that I use that has some different lessons on media literacy and fake news. So it's not like teachers have to necessarily go and find everything from scratch, which is the great thing about so many. And since there's been such a rise in fake news and in pictures, you know, that are photoshopped, I mean, for how long, you grocery store you go to and like National Enquirer, I don't even know if it exists anymore, but you see like these pictures like UFO like lands and the aliens meet with the president or something. And it looks so real. I just totally made that up, but that might've actually been on the cover. And just because it's there, just because it's in print, you know, how do you know it's real? I mean, I could print anything. I could make a newsletter and put all kind of news in it and share it out and be like, yeah, this is totally true. So how do you evaluate that? And so you can use some of those online sources because it has a lot of content, which is good for teachers too, to go through. And it's surprising the first time that I had done some of those, I was like, whoa, I actually thought that was real. But then the other thing too, is looking at the website, you know, Wikipedia is most often, that's one of the first things that comes up when you search anything. Just the number of results that you get, but looking at who it is it, you know, a secure website? Has it been updated? Looking at the description and even going to places like Common Sense Media or Common Sense Education, if you're looking at, you know, articles or look for other resources to see if they've evaluated things. There's a lot out there, but it's not always easy. But I think, you know, starting with one of those, like I mentioned, to get the kids, and it's fun to see their responses and to have the conversations like, what made you think that that was real? Like, why did it look like a legitimate social media profile or something, for example?
You gave me an idea. I feel like I should just like start spreading fake news and be like, oh, my podcast is the number one podcast across the globe, 1 million listeners. And you're right. I could probably just create a great Canva ad and just distribute everywhere, print it off, send it off on social media. And you're right. Mm-hmm. Like anyone could write anything.
Right.
And you bring up Wikipedia too. Like, I don't, do you watch The Office by any chance?
Well, you know, what's funny is that prior to October 2020, I had never watched Netflix and I had never seen The Office, but I binge watched The Office before they took it off of Netflix. So I have actually.
Do you remember that episode about Michael Scott talking and referencing Wikipedia?
Yes.
And he was talking about fake news. Yes. He was, I think the quote was like, Wikipedia is the best thing ever.
Yeah.
Anyone in the world can write anything they want about any subject.
Right.
So you know you're getting the best possible information.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I was dying
it was
laughing.
So funny.
But it's so true though. Like anyone can write anything out there, and you're right. Like it's getting even harder for me as an adult to distinguish mm-hmm. what's real and what's fake. So at a young age, I can't only imagine how hard that is for kids to figure that out.
Yeah. Because you know, if it's on the internet, it has to be right. It has to be up to date and current.
Yeah. Switching gears for a second, I just want to think about the future. A hot topic in my school, at least in my accounting classroom, is the metaverse and virtual reality and what that looks like and what Meta or AKA Facebook is now right. planning to do, what Google's doing. So I'm curious from your opinion and your thoughts, because I get a lot of opinions from 16-year-old students. Mm-hmm. First off, what do you know about the metaverse?
Yeah.
And in your opinion, do you see this as perhaps a fit in the world of education? What do you envision?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, I know a lot more about the metaverse just because the STEAM course that I teach is on emerging technology. And so we do a lot with augmented virtual reality, artificial intelligence, in addition to like what I mentioned, starting with the basics, because like the students, just because they have the tech doesn't mean they actually know how to use it or to find information on it. But we've been talking about the metaverse for a while now. And, you know, it's surprising because it's become this new topic, but it's something that has actually existed for a while and people don't necessarily know that. So when you think of, you know, what is the metaverse? It's this virtual space where you can pretty much do anything. You know, you can work in the metaverse. You can have an avatar. You can go shopping in the metaverse. You can have conversations in the metaverse. You don't really necessarily need to have, you know, like the headsets, but a lot of what they're showing is you got the headsets on, but it's just a digital world. And I've shown a couple of videos in my STEAM class recently, well, actually within the last month, probably. And one of them was Mark Zuckerberg talking about what he envisions the metaverse to be. Then there was another one that Walmart had made, and it was showing how you can like go shopping in the metaverse. And it was like the most, it was really interesting because the students were like, yeah, but can't you kind of do that now? Because if you do curbside express, like what's the difference? I said, well, you know, you have the avatar who's like telling you, oh, well, while you're waiting, I'm checking on your oil change. And are you sure you want that milk? Because at home in your fridge, your milk is 3/4 of a gallon full. But then there are some schools, I think it's Stanford, who is doing some and started, I think actually in June of last year, was doing, you know, learning in the metaverse. And then I brought this up in conversation with my students the other day. I said, you know, we're talking about NFTs and blockchain and metaverse, like all these topics, which is great. I get all excited about it. But I said, just imagine, you know, businesses, companies that want to operate a business, but renting a place in a building in a town is very expensive. So they create this office space using these web-based virtual reality spaces where if somebody wants to join in with a headset, they can. If they don't want to, they don't have to, but they're in the metaverse and they're running their business. They're having meetings. They're doing, you know, whatever their business is. They're selling items in that space and they don't actually have to leave wherever they are. And is that good or bad? And it's like, well, it's kind of isolating if you're just sitting at home and you're never leaving. But with school, you know, there have been a lot more conversations about what that's going to look like for students and in the future, and the future not being, you know, like 30 years from now, like it's happening now in some cases where they are just engaged in learning in this space, which is virtual reality with everything mixed into, I mean, you can do everything in it.
So this is blowing my mind. So you're saying this is happening literally right now. Like you said, Stanford was a school that was already learning in the metaverse.
I'm pretty sure that they had, I'd have to look up the video, but I just showed one the other day, a couple of days ago. And, you know, and even like real estate, I mean, they're selling real estate in the metaverse, and it's just this network of these, you know, three-dimensional worlds where people can, you know, hey, you want to grab a coffee at Starbucks, and you just, it's like, you're actually there. You can buy clothing for your avatar in the metaverse. And which I think, okay, but if I'm getting the coffee at Starbucks, like does the coffee actually appear in my house, you know, right? Like, cause that would be essential.
Did you ever play the game as a kid, like called The Sims?
I didn't because I wasn't quite a kid at that point, but I do know what it is. Yeah.
I feel like the metaverse reminds me of essentially that game.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. That's what I picture when people say the metaverse is like you get this avatar, you get to walk around and you could literally do everything and anything that you can in the real world, like literally buy land as you're talking about, and, you know, buy and sell products. And I don't know, I'm trying to picture this in like an educational setting and I find it, I can't wrap my head around it. I don't know if it's because I haven't experienced it yet or see it. But I guess just trying to relate it to my experience with Zoom teaching and Zoom education. I'll be honest, like my experience, even though our school did such a great job with putting together all the tech and all that stuff, it still couldn't replicate what it's like to be in the actual classroom. Like it was nowhere close. Yeah. And I imagine in my own brain, the metaverse would be the same thing. It'd be cool, but it would never replicate the same thing. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, here's what the difference is. And, you know, there are, I don't even know how many now, because there were at least, I don't know, between 5 and 8, we'll say, but there are new web-based virtual reality tools being developed every day. So they're virtual meeting spaces. It's often called WebXR. There's Mozilla Hubs, there's Frame VR, there's Sina 360, there's Spatial Chat. I mean, the list goes on and on. Eduverse is another one. And what they are essentially is like a website, and you can create, and it's like the metaverse. You create, it could be your office space. And so you design and you walk through, and now I don't need to have a headset. I can have it on like this, but here you and I are clearly in a Zoom meeting or in a Teams meeting. When we're in those spaces, we're clearly in separate places. I can hear people talking, but it's not like they're right next to me. Now, the difference in those web-based places is that you have an avatar. Now, some of them are really interesting because one of them uses your webcam to take your selfie, then it generates an avatar. And with the artificial intelligence built in, the webcam's on, but it's your avatar, it's not actually your face. And if you're laughing or smiling, rolling your eyes, it is mirroring that and tracking your motion. So when you're in those spaces, I know, it gets better. When you're in those spaces, so in Zoom and Teams and all that, you know, we can hear each other. I can see you, but I know you're not sitting next to me. But in those spaces, just like in the metaverse, your avatar is moving around the space. So you and I in that, you know, there could be 15 of us. So let's say I'm teaching a class, and in Teams, 15 separate, you know, even if you see, you don't even necessarily see your students, like you see a ceiling fan or the wall, or there's like nothing on the camera. But in the metaverse, you have the avatar. So 15 of you are gathered around in the front. You can stream your video, stream a presentation, put pictures on the wall, put PDFs on the wall, write on the wall, whatever, and set up separate rooms that are like meeting spaces. You use the, I always forget if it's a WASD or the arrows to move around in that space. So I might say, all right, class, come to the front of the room. So all of the avatars come towards me, has spatial sound. Wow. So as you come near, if I'm on the web or if I'm in the headset, like I hear everybody talking next to me. So like in your classroom, imagine when the kids are talking, when you're talking, you can kind of hear that chatter because they're near you. But if I then say, hey, okay, now I want you to break into small groups. You go over there, you go to that meeting room, you come over here. As they separate, you in the front, you can't hear the other groups because the sound goes where they are. So you can do the small break like rooms like that. And that's what's happening in the metaverse. And the other thing that's kind of curious about this is in higher education, they're looking at having what they're calling like digital twinning, where it's like a digital, a virtual representation replica of, you know, the person, of the teacher who is interacting in the metaverse, but can also be in the physical classroom. And so, these are things that have just come out in the last couple of weeks. Like it's amazing. And so the benefit, I mean, having Teams and having Zoom, it's great because when we were virtual and you couldn't be in the same physical space, that's as good as it got. But when you're in these other web-based meeting spaces, you can design an office, you can design a classroom, whatever you want, change the background. You can hang your own pictures on the wall, like it's your living room. I mean, it's really unbelievable. I did a presentation about a year ago in one of those, and it was pretty neat. But in these spaces, you feel more connected than you do in like Zoom or Teams, because you actually feel and sense the people standing next to you because the avatars are there and you hear them talking right next to you as opposed into their individual spaces on Zoom or Teams, for example.
Raja, I feel like you've you gave me more questions that I can't even have time to even, I'm looking at the time, like we've ran out of time and I feel like I need another hour to,
oh my gosh.
You've blown my mind away. I don't know if I should feel scared of all these amazing things or like confused.
Yeah.
But I feel like I need to follow up with you in the future, but yeah. I'm looking at the time. I want to make sure we wrap things up. So a couple of follow-up questions. First off, do you have any conferences or PD or any, you know, apps that you would recommend teachers to go look at if they're interested in learning more about digital literacy or just finding some cool tools to use in their classroom?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot, and some of which you wouldn't necessarily think of. I mean, Nearpod is always one that I recommend just because it has ready-made lessons on so many topics. So for teachers who think, oh, you know, I just don't have the time, because who has time, right? We're all so busy, yeah. But to be able to go to Nearpod and, you know, log in and find some lessons. And sometimes they're longer lessons. You can always add your own content in, but sometimes it's a short, it might be a video. It might be one very short lesson, but focus. And even for different grade levels, content areas, you can search those. Fake news, for example, is one of them. And then even some game-based learning tools like Kahoot or Quizzes have different...
Oh, my favorite.
Yeah, there you go. So then you just look up and search that term. And of course, as with all things, you want to check because sometimes it's students that are creating them and mistakes, as we know, are often made. But you can find some quick games or lessons, which is even better in some of those. You know, add in your own content or supplement with a video, for example. But those are a couple, or even, you know, the Checkology one, the News Literacy Project, I think is what it's actually called, or it's part of. Common Sense always has resources. If you search media literacy, digital literacy can give you some ideas for that too. And then as far as conferences, you know, ISTE for the summer, and pretty much every conference, I mean, even there's a lot of online events. Ed Webb puts on a lot of different webinars. Dr. Desiree Alexander, who I just did a webinar for today. I've done a couple for her. She has a lot of different people presenting on different topics. And so I'm sure that a lot of this is covered throughout some of those that are coming up too.
Fantastic. Rochelle, do you have any exciting projects coming up for teachers to look forward to, whether it's keynote speaking, podcasts, books? What do you got coming up?
Yeah. So I'm kind of in between the book writing because my seventh one came out in December, but I have a community on Facebook. It's called Thriving EDU. That's my other Twitter account. It's my LLC. The word thrive actually stands for something, but what we do is, you know, for anybody who's looking for a community and doesn't know where to begin, like Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, I have that Thrive in EDU community, and usually once or twice a week, normally twice a week, we go live and we have an educator. We talk about different topics. It streams out on different spaces like YouTube, LinkedIn, and Twitter, and you know, share ideas, talk about, like yesterday was International SEL Day, so it was all about SEL. And then, so that's a great space. And then coming up this summer, I have ISTE in person in NOLA. So looking forward to that. And I'm trying to think what else. Podcast. I have my own podcast, which has been me just talking to myself over the last couple of years. But I've actually been downloading some of our live episodes with our guests for the podcast because conversations have been so good. And then I guess just my blog or reaching out on Twitter with any questions that anybody has. You know, I'm not an expert, but I'm happy to share anything that I've written or researched and spent time so I can save time for somebody else.
That's incredible. You mentioned Twitter. Where else can teachers or parents or administrators find you on social media?
Yeah, so Twitter, Instagram, I'm RDENE915. My blog site, same thing, just add a .com to that. If you want to send me an email, just add a Gmail to that. And then on LinkedIn, you can find me just with my name, Rochelle Denae Pove.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Rochelle. This was so much fun to talk about. 30 minutes went by way too quickly. I have so many more questions. I opened up a can of worms there.
That's okay.
But thank you so much for hopping on today. I know you're super busy and I really appreciate you taking time to share some of your knowledge with us today.
Yeah, thank you. And you know, anytime you want to have a follow-up conversation about any of those things, just let me know because I really do. I love talking about like all the metaverse, NFTs, AI, you name it.
That's awesome. And thank you so much to all our listeners today. If you enjoyed our conversation, feel free to follow us on Instagram and on Facebook. And of course, don't forget to hit that subscribe button on Apple, Spotify, Google, and any other streaming platforms. Folks, we'll all see you next week. Take care.